And I'm Paul Harris. Welcome back. The News Talk 1120 KMOX. That music, of course, was the longtime music for the classic TV game show, Newlywed Game, created by Chuck Barris and hosted by this guy right here, Bob Eubanks. Hello, Bob.
How are you, Paul?
I'm doing just fine. Bob has got a book out now, kind of a story of his life, autobiography called It's in the Book, Bob.
You know, it's really not an autobiography, Paul. It's I happen to think that celebrity books are really boring. I mean, no one wants to know what I did when I was a teenager. This is a book about the interesting people that I've dealt with in my life, the Beatles, the Stones, Dylan, Elton, Merle Haggard, Marty Robbins, Dolly Parton. It's just a compilation of all these interesting, wonderful stories about some of the most important people in the world, really.
Yep, and I want to talk to you about those. Let's just get past this one question about the Newlywed Game.
Okay.
For a long time, you said the story wasn't true, and then there I see you a couple of years ago on World's Greatest Game Show Moments, and it turns out to be true.
Well, the way the urban myth goes was not true. It was even worse than that. You know, but I did a tongue-in-cheek and called the book It's in the Book, Bob.
Yes.
And so that's where I got the title. But, you know, you'll have to, if you read the book, you'll see what the real
yep.
story
oh, really
is.
Oh, I read it, and you actually don't do a whole long thing on it because there isn't all that much to say about it.
No.
But I didn't want to get bogged down in it here today because I got so much other stuff to talk about.
Wonderful.
I honestly have something I wanted to talk to you about
okay. For
like 30 years.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm a huge Beatles fan.
Are you good?
And I started out in music radio just as you did. So I want to know how a guy on KRLA in Los Angeles, which was at the time one of the two competing top 40 stations there with KFWB, you two were going head-to-head there. How does Bob Eubanks, the 6 to 9 p.m. DJ there, become the promoter of the Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl?
Well, first of all, I wasn't a very good disc jockey. I was there at the number one rocker, and I was surrounded by some great guys like Dick Biondi and Casey Kasem, Wink Martindale, Charlie O'Donnell. And I was this little twerpy guy from Oxnard, California. So I figured I better do something to make myself a little more valuable around the station. I was buying some talent at the time for some young adult nightclubs that I had, and Stevie Wonder, Ike and Tina Turner, Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, people like that. So I had a talent buying history with the agencies. And when the Beatles decided to tour, the only concert promoter in L.A. decided that he didn't want to buy them for $25,000. He turned them down. He was used to buying Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald for $10,000. So I went out and borrowed $25,000 on my house, had never produced a concert before, and produced the Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl 64. After that, I did 100 concerts a year for 20 years, really.
Now, you had to lay out $25,000. You had to go to the bank for that. How much were you making as a disc jockey in 1964?
$15,000 a year, man.
Let's see. I'm making $15,000, and I'm going to need $25,000. I better go to the bank. And the first bank you went to, what did they say?
He kicked me out. He told me to leave. He says, you know, we take better care of our investors than to do something stupid like that. So I went to a little storefront bank called Transworld Bank. They had just repoed a motorcycle. It was leaking oil on the floor. But the manager's son was a Beatle fan. So I walked in and I said to this lady, Liz Miller, I said, here's what I want to do. And she loaned me the money.
Was that first banker you went to what would have been called at the time a square who didn't know anything about the Beatles?
He was a jerk, a pompous idiot sitting across, you know, how some bankers can be. And so, but it worked out.
See, you know, I picture a scene like that great scene in Pretty Woman where Julia Roberts finally goes back to Rodeo Drive and goes up to that woman after she's bought all these things. Says, remember, you work on commission, right? Remember I was here and you didn't do it? Big mistake. Did you ever do that, go back to that banker and say, remember that Beatles concert you wouldn't back? Big mistake.
He probably still doesn't know who the Beatles are. It's okay.
Now, after putting up $25,000 and having to pay off the Hollywood Bowl and the Beatles and whoever else was involved in that, how much did Bob Eubanks take home?
Bob Eubanks made $1,000 that night. But I got to tell you something, Paul. I got real smart the second and third year.
Yeah.
And I ended up making more money than the act did the second and third year. If Brian Epstein knew that, he'd turn over in his grave.
Well, that's great. How much were ticket prices at the time?
Top dollar was $7.
Top dollar was $7 to go see the Beatles. And were there like $2 and $3 seats, too?
It was a 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And we sold 18,000 seats in three and a half hours and without computers. And I tried to get Brian Epstein to do a second show, but he would not do a second show. He was afraid they wouldn't sell it out. I said, you got to be kidding me, man. I could sell out 10 shows.
Yeah, and the guy at the Hollywood Bowl you write in the book about, he said, well, we've never sold tickets to any event in just one day, so yeah. We're not really worried about that.
That's exactly right. You know, but it was a fascinating time. And as I look back, you know, it was after I did the first one, I swore I'd never do another one. But it's sort of like pregnancy, I think. You know, the woman, when she's going through childbirth, she says, I'll never do this again. But then it kind of, the memory kind of fades and you do it again, you know.
How much did the Beatles make on that first concert? You made a grand. How much did Ringo and John and Paul and George take?
Well, I don't know what they made on the first one, but I can tell you this. 1966, Dodger Stadium. I paid them $120,000. And I sat down one night and I tried to figure it out. They had a 25% manager, they had a 10% agent, they had a chartered airplane, they had an entourage, they paid for the opening acts, some of the security. If they made $4,000 apiece that night, I would have been amazed.
Wow.
So they weren't making any money on the road. They were tired of each other. This is 66. The drug thing had started to eke into the group at that time, and they were ready to get off the road. I produced the second to the last concert they ever appeared in together. They went to Candlestick Park after that, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the opening acts you had for the boys?
Last year, the 66, it was Bobby Hebb, who had a thing called Sonny,
yep.
The Ronettes. In the first year, I think Righteous Brothers, Bill Black Combo, Jackie DeShannon.
These were all singers who were there in front of a house band?
They brought their own band.
Oh, each act had their own band?
Yeah, each act had their own band.
Wow.
But, you know, and it's so funny because the Beatles showed up with three amplifiers and a set of drums. In today's market, they'd show up with four semi-trailers, you know?
Yeah, the difference today would be somebody would actually hear the music. Nobody heard a note, right?
No, because of the screaming. But the writer on the Beatle contract is kind of funny. My writer said, and that's the addendum to the contract, I had to provide a case of Coca-Cola, clean towels, an adequate sound system, and a television. I told them to get their own TV.
Oh, that's funny. Now, somewhere at home in my vast record collection, yes, I do still have some of that old vinyl, I have the Beatles at the Hollywood album, a Hollywood Bowl album. Did any of my money go to you?
No. What happened, they came to me, Capitol Records came to me in 64 and said, we'd like to record. They had to get my permission because I had the building. And I said, fine, you can record, but I want to write the liner notes. So when the Beatles heard their performance at the Bowl 64, they didn't like it. And they refused to let Capitol release it. Capitol then put together this album in the 70s, which was, I think, sort of a compilation of 64, 65.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to me and said, we don't want you to write the liner notes. We want George Martin, who was their record producer, to write the liner notes. I said, hey, that's cool. Get out your checkbook. And they did. So if you bought the album, no, the money did not go to me.
It kind of went to you just in a kind of back room kind
of
way, because they paid you ahead of time, and I see.
So.
All right, now the other thing I've been meaning to ask you for a few years is, do you know a guy by the name of Al Wyman?
Oh, I know that name.
Al Wyman has been a television reporter here in St. Louis for years and years and years and years and years, but in 1964, he was a news guy for KFWB.
Oh, sure, that's why I know the name.
Your big rival Top 40 radio station at the time.
Well, the Beatles joined us at KRLA, and that kind of wiped KFWB off the map.
Yeah, you guys put him out of business there for a little while.
Yeah, I thought I knew that name.
Yeah.
First of all, I love your town, by the way, and I'm very proud to say that I host the Variety Club Telethon every year.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's one of the reasons you're well-known here. But I got to tell you this Al Wyman story, because I had Al on the show a couple of years ago to talk about this, and he actually has tape of it, and you may not even know about this. But at this big event that you from KRLA promoted with the Beatles, this, you know, biggest concert in 1964 in Los Angeles, Al got credentials and was there standing next to the stage with his little recorder, which in those days, you know, wasn't all that little.
Right.
1964 tape recorders were kind of big, and was actually recording them on the air, and then went backstage and found a payphone and called in to KFWB and played some of that music from the little speaker on his tape recorder telephone and onto the air. And he said, I think we had that Beatles concert on the air before anybody from KRLA, which was involved in the concert, had it on the air. Did you know about that?
He may have done that, but I got to tell you, we had a disc jockey at the station, and we talk about in the book, Dave Hull.
The Hullabalooer.
Yeah, the Hullabalooer. And David, he made a contact at the pressing plant where the Beatles records were pressed, And this guy would slip Dave a Beatles record before it was ever on the streets, and we would play it.
Yeah.
And it about drove KFWB crazy.
I'm sure it did.
About drove the Beatles crazy, too. They couldn't figure out what was going on either.
Now, we'll get off this Beatles thing in just a minute, but I'm a big fan, and
I
never had a chance to ask you about these things before. But tell me about, after they did this concert for you this one night, they didn't leave L.A. They did other things. Were you involved in some of these parties that they went to?
No, not at all. You see, my whole Beatle contact was... I was not necessarily a huge fan, even though I was a fan and a disc jockey, but I approached it on strictly a business level. My whole thing was to get that concert done, promoted, and everybody happy. So I was not involved in the social things that went on. I was not a fifth Beatle like the Hullabaloo was. I really approached it strictly on a business level.
So you did not go to this famous Hollywood party where the Beatles met Edward G. Robinson?
No. And honestly, if you had mentioned my name to Paul McCartney right now, he would not know who I am. Yet I produced, you know, probably the most famous concert that they've ever appeared in.
Yeah. You mentioned in the book that McCartney, during that 2-day stay in Hollywood, went to, like, Burt Lancaster's house, and John Lennon was looking down Jane Mansfield's dress.
Yeah.
And it must have been weird for them, too.
I'm sure it was weird. You know, they were four very naive young guys at the time, but boy, were they glib. They were like a stand-up comedy routine. They played off each other. They were wonderful. The first year, they were great. Second year, they were fine. The third year, they were really a pain.
Yeah, that first year, though, when things were so crazy, you write in the book that the hotel and that they were supposed to stay at, I think the Ambassador and the Burbank Airport, they kind of backed away and didn't want to have anything to do with these guys because it was going to be too crazy, right?
It was crazy, yeah. And the LAPD, I got a call from the New York guys, the agency, said, you're going to have to get motorcycle escorts and all that. Well, I called LAPD, and they said, well, you're going to have to pay for anything you get. And I said, whoops. And the New York guys got pretty mad at me, but I don't blame L.A. I really don't. And just because an act comes to town, no need you have to spend taxpayers' money to protect them.
Talking with Bob Eubanks, the book is called It's in the Book, Bob, and talks about the Newlywed Game, which he hosted for years, but we're talking about his connection to rock and roll, which, as you mentioned, included these nightclubs you owned, the Cinnamon Cinder nightclubs, is that what they
were
called?
Right, young adult nightclubs. You know, I had a chain of them, and... You know, we would have Ike and Tina Turner and Stevie Wonder, Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, people like that appear.
You say in the book that Ike and Tina were your favorites because Tina had this magnetic stage presence.
Oh, she was amazing, man, I'm telling you. And I would say to Tina, I said, Tina, the cops are out there, you know, they're trying to nail me for dirty dancing. This is back in the 60s, so you can imagine what that was like.
Yeah.
She said, don't worry, honey, and she'd get out there on that stage, and she'd look over at me and wink and just start her body rotating, and the room would just come alive.
And were you thinking to yourself, well, I'm losing my license tonight.
This is it. I'm out of business. You know, thanks, Tina.
And speaking of East St. Louisans, which Ike and Tina were at the time, what was your relationship like with Chuck Berry? You had him at the club, right?
I had a good relationship with Chuck Berry, and you know, I had him at the clubs. The only thing Chuck wanted was to be paid in cash ahead of time.
Why is that?
and I understand he still wants that. But one of my great moments was about 5 years ago at the Variety Club Telethon. I sat in a room with Chuck Berry and Ray Charles, just the three of us.
Oh, man.
And I thought that was such an important time for me, man, to sit with those two legends, to listen to them talk. I just sat there dumbfounded, man, because I thought, you know, with royalty, really. And it was really cool.
Yeah, those are two guys who pretty much have seen all there is to see.
You're not kidding. You know, I'm still a big Chuck Berry fan. I really am. I think Chuck's wonderful. I wish he'd come back in the Variety Club Telethon.
Well, you know, he still plays at the Duck Room at Blueberry Hill on a monthly basis here
in
St. Louis.
That's what I hear. And I almost ran into him in Reno. He was at Reno the other night. He played a casino there. He's still making a lot of money, and he's still Chuck Berry.
Still taking it in cash? Really?
I don't know. All I know is you got to pay him ahead of time.
Wow. and let's talk about some of the other people. The Rolling Stones, you promoted one of their concerts.
Two of their concerts.
They weren't quite as big as the Beatles concerts, but still pretty big in 64 and 65,
well,
right?
Well, 65. My first Beatle concert was 65. I paid them $4,500, and they sold out a 4,000-capacity building. The second year, I paid them $20,000, and they sold out a 13,000-capacity building. But Jagger and I, we were oil and water. We could not get along, and life is too short to deal with that kind of stuff. Same with Elton and Manilow, by the way. I couldn't get along with them.
Oh, really? Because their egos got in the way?
Yeah, well, you know, they did stupid things. I remember I did an Elton John concert in Las Vegas, and before the show, that one of his guys came to me, and he says, I have something to talk to you about. He says, Elton will not come out of the dressing room if he sees a policeman in a uniform. He hates cops. I said, well, that's cool. Then Elton could have either nude cops or no cops. Now, which one do you want? know, and even just a pain in the neck. Manilow was tough, really, really tough. And I just, you know, as I said, life is too short to deal with that kind of
Bob, joke. You may be the only person who puts Barry Manilow and the word tough in the same sentence.
Well, that may be true.
I don't know, but no, people don't usually think of him that way. And in the book, you also talk about a Bob Dylan concert you did where half the crowd left.
Mm-hmm.
Because he went electric, was that it?
Yeah, the first time I'd ever seen hippies. This is Hollywood Bowl, 1965, is a week after the Beatle concert, and first time I'd ever seen hippies. The strangest people in the world walked in, and so Dylan got up on stage, and he was acoustic, and he sang his songs, and everybody he had Like a Rolling Stone. It was out at the time, and everybody kept saying, "Sing Like a Rolling Stone." He said, "Oh man, I didn't bring a G harmonica," and about 12 of them hit the stage, bam, bam, bam. So he picked one of them up and he played Like a Rolling Stone. So we go to intermission. He comes back. He plugs in, and half the audience walked out.
Wow. Wow. Bob Eubanks, the book is in, it's in the book, Bob. And by the way, he's got a website. It's in the book, Bob.com.
Or, no, BobEubanks.com.
Okay.
And there is an, it's in the, yes, there is a, it's in the book, Bob. But, you know, the book's available bookstores, Amazon.com. It's available at BobEubanks.com. It's a fun book. It really is.
It is. And let me take a break, and we'll come back and chat some more, okay?
Thanks, Paul.
Bob Eubanks here on the Paul Harris Show. Not just the guy from the Newlywed Game. What a life he's led. We'll have more of that in a moment on KMOX. And I'm Paul Harris talking with Bob Eubanks, the host of the Newlywed Game in various incarnations. I think there were three or four different times that
I'm
Bob...
I'm not sure, Paul, but four times, I think.
Four
by the
times.
Way, go Cardinals.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, we hope that they can go tonight. They had a little problem with stop and go last night. anyway, in the last segment, Bob, you were talking about Elton John and the police officers. If you don't mind, a listener of mine by the name of Dave has a story to share with you. Dave,
okay.
Say hello to Bob Eubanks.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, David.
In the mid-80s, there, when what is now called Fair St. Louis was called the VP Fair, they were trying to figure out how to get Elton John through a crowd of 100,000 people to the dressing room, and they dressed him as a St. Louis policeman.
Oh, that's funny. What a great story.
Doesn't that go perfectly?
Oh, I will write that one down and use it in the next book.
And you can credit Dave in St. Louis for telling you that.
That is so funny. You know, I mean, they were adamant. You know, first of all, the guy was running around saying, nobody could take pictures of Elton. I said, great, you're going to go out and take the cameras away? He says, yep. So he came back with his toupee down over his ear somewhere and all disheveled. And then he lays this one on me that Elton won't come out of the dressing room. And Elton was over in the corner with Billie Jean King, and hands were waving, and they were screaming and yelling. But he came out of the dressing room. That's a great story.
That was bizarre. Thanks for calling, Dave. I appreciate that. Let's talk about some other music people. We're going to get to the Newlywed Game here for people who are wondering. We're going to get to that in a minute here, or a few minutes anyway. Let's talk about some of these other music people, because I think this is a part of your life that until people read the book or hear us talking about it today, they don't necessarily know this about you. You worked very closely with Dolly Parton for a couple of years, didn't you?
I was Dolly's manager, yeah. I signed Porter Wagoner. I bought 100 dates on Porter Wagoner in 1972, and he had this blonde working for him named Dolly Parton, who was making $500 a night at the time.
How old would she have been then?
I don't know. I don't remember. But anyway, Dolly came to me about a month after we were on tour. Dolly came to me one night, and you know, the only time that Dolly and I could talk was when Porter was on stage, because Porter was quite protective. And she says, I want to leave Porter. I said, huh? She said, I want to leave Porter and go out on my own. I want you to manage me. And I thought, oh, my God. First of all, I had a big investment. Secondly, I knew I'd be on Porter's hit list, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
And but she left, and I managed her. And then about a year later, she came to me and she says, I'm getting too much heat from the Nashville good old boys. They don't want me to have a West Coast manager. And at that time, the only artist that had a West Coast manager in country was Johnny Cash. So she left, and a year later, she came back to me and wanted me to manage her again. I went home and talked over to my wife and made one of the dumbest decisions I've ever made. I said, Dolly, I can't do it. So that was, and for some reason, Dolly and I are estranged. I have no idea what went wrong. I really don't know, but whatever it is. You know?
Maybe she didn't want you to really let her go.
Well, I really don't know what the situation is, but when she did 9 to 5, I was producing the Tony Tennille show, and I had Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin on the show, but we couldn't get Dolly on the show. I just really do not know, but it's okay.
And how about your buddy Merle Haggard, who writes the foreword for your book here?
Yeah, Hag's a good friend. I'm the biggest Merle Haggard fan in the world. I think he's a genius, an absolute genius. When you listen to Haggard's music, it's so different and it's so unique. I just really am a Merle Haggard fanatic.
Now, speaking of unique people, here's how we get back to the newlywed game. Tell me about your relationship with Chuck Barris. How did you two first meet, and how did the newlywed game become kind of synonymous with you?
I got the newlywed game on a $5 bet. I was playing a basketball team with Bobby Boris Pickett, who had a song called Monster Mash.
Sure. Every radio station in America will be playing it Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Yeah.
And he was doing some commercials. I asked him who his agent was, and he told me Noel Rubeloff. And my friend Charlie O'Donnell said, well, you can't sign with Noel Rubeloff. You don't have any credits. So I bet Charlie $5 I could sign with this agent. That was Wednesday night. I met the agent on Friday, met Chuck Barris on Saturday, and got the newlywed game.
Holy cow. That's a nice weekend right there.
Yeah, just the right time, right place. You know, Barris was wonderful to me. He was very fair. He let me learn how to do the show. In today's marketplace, I'd have been fired the first week.
Why? So, what were you doing wrong?
Well, I was scared. I didn't know what I was doing. He came to me after the first show. He said, I need to talk to you. I said, what's the matter? He says, I've just done something I've never seen anybody do before. I said, what? He said, you went a whole half hour without blinking. So I had to write myself a note, you know, blink, dummy. But, you know, he let me learn how to do the show. Today, with the clicker, with the remote control, if you don't have something funny every 10 minutes, you lose them. Well, we used to think if we had a funny moment every show, we had a good show.
Well, you know what's funny about that to me, Bob, as a broadcaster, is, you know, I see the reruns on the Game Show Network.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, how scary is that to see yourself in those clothes?
Well, I'll tell you about that, too. Go ahead, though.
Okay. But when I see you, as a broadcaster, I see you doing something that not enough people understand how to do, and that is the ability to pause and let nothing happen for a moment until the other person fills the void.
Yeah, if you stare at people, they feel it's like it's still their turn to talk, and that's when they will tell you the things that they don't want to tell you.
That, to me, was the genius of what you did on the Newlywed Game.
Learned that from Johnny Carson. I used to watch John because at first I didn't know how to handle delicate situations. But I watched John, and John would say 1,000 words with an expression. And see, Carson was not a comedian. He was a funny guy. And there's a big difference. Comedians make lousy game show hosts because they're always thinking of the next funny line, and they don't listen to the contestants.
Yep.
And so, but Carson was a master.
And how did you know when you had people there who you could push a little bit further and who, because they might have had the wrong kind of personality, you had to back off of?
Well, they would give me a personality profile of the couples before the show and show me Polaroid pictures. But after the first question, I sort of knew what I had, you know, and I would just hone in on my strengths of that group then.
Was that show heavily edited? Was it?
No.
No.
No, it truly wasn't. We tried to put together an outtake reel one time. There was only about 3 things that happened in all the years that couldn't be aired.
Huh. And I got to ask you, this is kind of the standard talk show question here. Chuck Barris and the CIA and the Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, any
Bobby
truth?
Banks is Mary Poppins, okay?
But what did you think of the movie?
I thought it was, I didn't enjoy the movie. I just thought it was ridiculous personally. But, you know, in that movie, there's a lady named Olga who made that terrible faux pas on the air.
Yes.
And they called her up and they said, Olga, we're going to put you in the movie. She said, no, please don't. I'm a grandmother. They said, well, it's worth $5,000. She said, you go right ahead and put me in the movie.
That's the classic in the blank, Bob.
Yes, everybody has a price, don't they?
Which takes you around to It's in the Book, Bob, which
That's
is the
correct.
Name of your book. Now, were there questions that you would not ask?
Yes, about 20% of the questions.
Well,
they would come to me again. These writers would be locked up in a room. They got a little crazy, you know. And they would come to me with all these goofy questions that I just wouldn't ask, you know, because it was my back end on the line out there. So, but they were very good about that. If I said, no, I won't ask that, they said, okay, next, and they would go on to something else. Tough job writing questions for that show because there's only about 5 subjects. You just have to shroud them with different points of view.
And somehow work the word whoopee in there.
Well, sometimes. We used to have a whoopee question almost every show, yeah.
I think you probably have said the word whoopee more than any other broadcaster in America.
I would imagine. What a great distinction. I'll put that on my tombstone.
Can you hang on for another segment, Bob?
Sure, man.
I appreciate it. Bob Eubanks, it's called It's in the Book, Bob. You can find it at all bookstores and Amazon.com and at BobEubanks.com. And we'll talk some more here in a moment. Wait until you hear about Bob Eubanks and Charles Manson. That's next on the Paul Harris Show on KMOX. And it's the Paul Harris Show back with Bob Eubanks. legendary host of the Newlywed Game for all those years. In the last segment, I mentioned your clothes. When you look back on those episodes that you did in those polyester suits, which I'm guessing were like Pierre Cardin or something like that from that era, what do you think when you see yourself?
That was Pierre Cardin.
Oh, I was right?
Yeah, if you lit a match to me, I'd have gone up in flames in about 2 seconds. Hey, well, you know, and, Paul, for just a second, while on the break, you know, they played a commercial for Dolly Parton there in St. Louis.
Yeah.
I can just urge your listeners to go see her show because she's a marvelous performer. She really is good at what she does.
How classy is this guy, Bob Eubanks? There's some sort of rift where Dolly doesn't even talk to him, but he still says, go see her show.
She's really a wonderful performer, and go see her show because she's a sweet lady. She really is. I don't know what happened, but whatever it is, it's okay.
Who knows? Now, I mentioned before the break also that there's something where your life and Charles Manson's life connected or at least intersected or something happened there. What's the story there?
Well, what happened is at the radio station KRLA, there was only one door into the radio station, and there were some steps out there. And the kids used to come and sit on the steps and talk to the disc jockeys and everything. And Dick Biondi, who's currently in Chicago and was the big disc jockey at WLS Chicago, he told me that first of all, Kathleen Sullivan, the news lady, used to hang out on the steps out there. And that Charlie Manson used to hang out on the steps out there. And I went, whoa, that's weird.
No, that's it? That he used to hang out there? What was he doing?
Like all the other kids, just hanging out. Want to see what the disc jockeys look like.
Wow.
I'm sure glad he didn't find me.
If only. But if only you had taken him aside and said, Charlie. It wouldn't have worked anyway.
The other weird connection is that I was having my hair. In the 60s, the big men's hairstylist in town was a fellow by the name of Jay Sebring. And he had a big men's hairstyling salon. It was the place to go. And Sebring was one of the guys at Sharon Tate's house that night.
Really?
That was killed, yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah, kind of weird.
That is very, very weird. And by the way, speaking of your hair, light a match to that, it would have gone up, too, on the Newlywed Game.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
And a big bonfire, too.
I had that hair back, man.
Well, listen, this is a terrific read, and I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about some of the other amazing aspects of your life here today, besides just the game show.
Can I tell you that it's a real pleasure to be on a powerful station like this? And, you know, I'll be doing the Variety Club Telethon in April, and I can only urge your listeners that this is the most wonderful charity in the world. It goes to the Children of St. Louis. The money stays right there. And also, I'm real proud to be the national spokesperson for a company called New Wave Incorporated. We teach people how to make money on the Internet. So if you're looking for a speaker or if you're looking for a New Wave, you can find me on BobEubanks.com.
And when you do come to town in April, come on this KMOX studio and we'll have some more fun.
I would love to do that. You know, Jan Albus and those folks out of Variety Club are just the best. And St. Louis ought to be very proud of this marvelous charity, and that's where I spend all of my charity time, is right there with the Variety Club.
It's a pleasure having you on today, Bob.
Thanks,
thank
Paul.
You.
You're
Bob Eubanks, the book is called It's in the Book, Bob. This is the Paul Harris Show on KMOX.